This episode of Rebel Talk is brought to you by Rebel Tech, human stories for startups. Rebel Shrebel, you've torn your dress. Rebel
Shrebel, your face is a mess. Renny Redzepi's in your restaurant.
Renny Redzepi from Noma.
Oh.
Which one?
Smokehouse.
Yeah.
And I said, so I'm in Tooting. I said, also, I've just ordered a Domino's. Rebel Shrebel, your face is a mess.
Hello and welcome to Rebel Talk, a brand new podcast that celebrates rebels across every walk of life. Each episode, we talk to the troublemakers whose predilection for bending the rules is driving progress, change, transformation. I'm your host, Mark Schwakey. I'm here with Neil Rankin, celebrated chef, restaurateur, and that guy who did something many of us have long aspired to do when he recently told Gordon Ramsay to fuck off. He's the owner of London's two, soon to be three, temper restaurants, and is known as much by his friends for his fiery outlook on life as he is by diners for his fiery cooking. The Observer's Jay Rayner recently wrote, "I love the fact that you can smell the wood smoke and the rendering meat from the door. I love the way that smell stays in your hair." Not for me, though, Jay. I'm bald. Neil, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You started our conversation this morning with the words I only ever hear as your greeting. Go on, say it.
I'm a little bit hungover.
You are a little bit hungover. What was last night?
It's the Scotch Egg Challenge.
What the fuck?
Oh, it's just basically this thing they do every year. It's in a pub in Islington, and this guy, Osh, who is a nightmare, and he's a landlord, and he just gets everybody pissed. And
what's the competition, though? Is it how many you eat?
No, I mean, you make 12 Scotch eggs. Somehow you have to pay to be there, which I didn't really understand why. Right. I pay him 30 quid for me bringing free eggs to him and filling his restaurant.
Yeah.
There was about 12 of London's best chefs all making Scotch eggs and getting absolutely
and then just
smashed.
And then just being judged.
Yeah.
Who else was there?
And then I only know what time I got home from my Uber receipt, which is quite common.
What time was it?
I think it wasn't that late. That was worrying. It was like about 12:30.
Yeah.
Again, it felt like 3.
Thank you for being here. So, Neil, you and I lived together in slightly fucked up circumstances during our days at Salford University. Now, what's interesting to me about those days is that we lived together and we ate like shit.
There was no good food.
You quite literally never cooked anything good for me during those. I don't think that's true.
I think I cooked some nice curries. And I was really good at French toast.
Yeah, you were okay at French toast, actually.
I used to make stacks of French toast, basically. Yeah. I remember like a huge pile, like a mountain of French toast. That was all I could do.
Neil Rankin, the reason I'm fat. In fact, lots about you. So I was going to try and use that as a clever link, but you've proven me wrong. The link was going to be, you never made me anything good, and now, look at you, you're one of London's most celebrated. But actually, in fact, lots of things about you have changed since then, including your relationship with your home city of Edinburgh, your career and life plan. So you studied acoustics, so were dead set on being a scientist.
Well, I mean, I was. No, I don't think I was dead set on being anything. I went to Manchester because it was Manchester.
Yeah.
I wanted to go to Manchester.
What was Manchester to you back then? Was it the music?
Hacienda.
Yeah.
Which we didn't go to that often.
We did a bit.
We did a bit, but we went to other places more.
Yeah, we did. But the one...
A lot.
But come on, try and make us a bit fucking cool. We did go to the Hacienda.
We did go to the Hacienda.
I remember...
But it wasn't the coolest thing when we got there,
I remember seeing the Stone Roses in the, in the Hacienda.
No, you went more, because you used to go to I was at the House Nights, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We'd go to those.
We went to Boulders a bit, but you know...
We went to Boulders a lot.
It was a strange and alien place to me.
That was... Yeah.
But what has remained intact is your strength and sense of self. Now, the things I love about you as a man, and of course... most people do when they hear you on TV or follow you on Twitter, is that you just are determined to follow your own rules and nobody else's. Now, this podcast is all about celebrating rebels, and that's why I thought of you. Tell me what happened with Gordon Ramsay.
I was actually in a tube when I wrote that. And
What did you write?
Well, I read that he was doing this programme about chefs on cocaine and apparently highlighting that there was a problem within the industry when people at work. And, I just don't find that to be true. I mean... I was not, you know, you went to university with me, so I wasn't the cleanest living guy before. And actually, when I started and became a chef, I didn't drink, I didn't do drugs, I stopped smoking, I worked 18-hour shifts day after day, you know, getting three hours a night sleep. You know, I was really passionate about getting into it, and I worked my...
But you put yourself up for that, didn't you?
Yeah, I worked fucking hard for it, and...
I mean, you went into restaurants asking for those shifts.
At no point would drugs during those services have helped me. I mean, they don't help you get better at stuff. They don't help you fillet fish better. You know, I mean,
but you went into,
and I also think, and my problem with him is, namely, is that his attitude towards Chef, this shouty, fuck off, you know, horrible way of bullying people, which has made him famous.
Is it not true?
It's not the case anymore. It just doesn't happen anymore. And I think the fault, the people that does happen with tend to be people that have worked with him.
And you were concerned about him portraying the industry in a bad way that was...
Yeah, and then saying everybody's on drugs, which just isn't true. I mean, look, not to say that my chefs don't go out afterwards and, you know, I'd be mad to think that the restaurant industry wasn't rife with cocaine. But not when you're at work,
yeah.
You know. And the same can be said for journalism. The same can be said for the acting industry. The same can be said for the music industry. The same can be said for almost any bloody industry you count it on. So to pinpoint, you know...
What was your problem with it, Nick?
Was it restaurant?
Was it about hiring new people and wanting to make it an industry that people were up for?
I mean, I just wanted to make a nicer industry. You know, we want people to want to join our industry, and I don't think his attitude towards this sort of bullying mentality and also telling everybody's on drugs really does us any favors.
Did he come back at you?
Nah, he hasn't said shit.
So it was just...
Of course he hasn't. I mean, everybody... The reason the story became big wasn't because of what I said. It was because of everybody else backing me up. Because everybody was like, ah... Somebody said it, you know. He's a wanker.
When you went looking for your new direction, and you took a left turn into food, was it always going to be food, or were you just looking for something different to be successful in? You were looking for a new way in, because you know, you said, you talk about how we cooked together. I mean, we were students. We were little boys playing at real life, but. You studied acoustics, so I assume then you didn't know anything about wanting to be a chef. Were you even into food?
But I don't think... I mean, I don't... I used to watch Ready, Steady, Cook.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the closest. I loved it.
Makes me think I could be a chef.
Well, no, I mean, I sort of got into... That was the sort of beginning when food programs started to come out.
Yeah.
And the idea of becoming a chef was a little bit more than... I wouldn't even consider it as a career when I was at school. I mean, the only people I saw that were cooking were people making food for us at school. It didn't look like a sexy career to me, you know? I didn't want to be a dinner lady.
You could have been.
Well, I could have been a dinner lady. I could have done that.
But in terms of the kind of food you're cooking, and I've tasted at both restaurants massively, that we'll talk about those in a minute, and looking forward to the third. You know, you're loved by reviewers and you get your fair share of media exposure. You've got television and press, and I saw you in South Africa last week at something that looked really interesting. But you've chosen an area of cooking that's unlikely to get you a Michelin star anytime soon. Is that a thing to you? Is that
I cook for people. I cook for...
What does that mean?
I think about things being delicious and things being homely and things being enjoyable. It's not really about the food per se. It's about the overall experience. You come into my restaurants, it's about enjoying yourself going out, which is, I think, why people go out. You know, very few people in this country go out for, you know, just the eating experience alone, which is why fine dining's kind of on a decline. Because without the atmosphere, without the enjoyment, you know, of going out, where are you? You know, it's got to be at such a high level.
Yeah.
And that's not really the food I like eating, so it'd be disingenuous for me to be cooking that.
What food do you love eating?
Curry.
Yeah.
And Thai food.
Yeah.
And Domino's pizzas.
Barbecue, tacos, wine, mezcal. But the ham and pineapple pizza taco, I think, is just... I don't know, I'm a big Hawaiian pizza fan.
And so talk about...
That's a lie. I don't eat Domino's anymore. I banned myself from them. But I did
phase.
I did have a phase where I was calling them at 9.
Yeah.
Because I worked out the app. You could order at 9 and they'll arrive at your door at like 11:05.
Yeah.
Which is so dangerous.
Yeah. Before bed.
Yeah.
Or just in bed.
Well, no, anytime. Actually, the guy, Reni Rezepi, he was the place Noma, which is like the world's best restaurant or whatever, was in my restaurant. And this food journalist called me and he was like, Reni Rezepi's in your restaurant. And I was like, oh.
Which one?
Smokehouse.
Yeah.
The old one. And I said, I'm in Tooting. I said, also, I've just ordered a Domino's. And he was like, oh.
I'll come over.
And he said, Reni wants to know what you've got on your Domino's. Yeah. And I was like, oh, yeah. So it's sun-dried tomato garlic sauce, which is essential in a Domino's, by the way. You don't go for the normal tomato sauce. It's terrible. Pineapple, because I'm a heathen, chilies and pork meatballs. And he turned around and he said, Rennie likes your order. Tells you to enjoy your Domino's. So I had my Domino's.
Domino's, anything Neil Rankin says about your regular tomato sauce is his opinion only.
No,
and will be treated
not,
as
it's
such.
Not, it's fact.
It's fact.
Fact.
It's, yeah.
The tomato sauce is terrible on a Domino's. It's what lets it down.
Let's do to make sure, in case there's people out there that still haven't been to Temper.
Or Domino's.
Or, well, no, they've... Okay, let's not go there, but let's talk about Temper. Okay. Temper number one in the city, Temper number two in Angel. Give listeners, in case they haven't been and want to spend some money on a great night out, quick
overview. So Temper number one in Soho is aimed on mezcal and tacos. It was just, you know... And we buy whole cows, we buy whole goats, we buy everything.
You know how to butcher these things in the back.
Yes, we butcher them all ourselves, and then we cook them all in different ways, and we use every little part of the animal. There's a sense of sustainability to it, which I don't think the vegan people quite got. For example, my restaurant uses one cow a week, and sustainable from tiny little farms across England. Something like Hawksmoor, which has a similar level of business, we use about 300 herd of cattle for that one restaurant. So, you know, there's no argument to say that the way we do it. They got offended by the whole animal barbecue thing because thinking I was going to put an animal in the spit in the middle of the room. Actually, I would have if it was possible, but
they thought it was just for theatre.
They thought it was a theatre thing, and it is a theatre thing. It's fun. You know, you sit in Temper, you
around
lots of mezcal, we've got loud hip-hop playing, you know, you've got fire, you've got barbecue food, people are getting a little bit dirty. It's a fun environment.
Yeah.
It's a night out.
Yeah, I mean, your Temper in Angel in the financial district in London is, you know, I love it for its food. It's that one's smokehouse barbecue with curry, and the alcohol is absolutely exquisite. The sitting around the fire is brilliant. The atmosphere is brilliant. What I really love is the crap 80s music that you pipe through the whole time. It's just
we did find that it was a bit too much for lunchtime. We've changed it.
Oh, what have you changed it to?
Well, it's just kind of plain because I don't think the general business customers were getting it. You know, you come in for a meeting and then you've got, you know, Aha playing in the background.
I loved it.
I love it, but I don't think they get it. It was a sort of tongue-in-cheek thing on American Psycho that I wanted to do in the city. I just like the idea of doing a sort of American Psycho-themed
like barbecue
curry restaurant.
Barbecue goat curry and Duran Duran. Who knew?
Exactly. Phil Collins and Masala.
But and just before you, I think, went really, really big, because since we've last sat down and spoken, you've won Observer Food Monthly's new Chef of the Year. And
Restaurant.
New Restaurant of the Year, which is fabulous, and it's a great thing to have. But it feels like you went really big about a year ago, 2 years ago, where I just turned around and saw my old mate everywhere. But before that, you'd got yourself a little niche as kind of... rather crassly called our barbecue king or our charcoals king. And you were talking on TV a bit about taking charcoals from all over the world because of the different smoke flavours. There's a Michael Pollan book called Cooked.
Yeah, I really like it. I've seen the one on Netflix.
Yeah.
He does a series. It's one of the best TV series.
Oh, really?
It's really, really good.
But I feel like you've prioritised that commitment to simplicity and great cooking above being whatever restaurant industry calls a perfect chef.
Yeah, I mean, it's about enjoyment, though, isn't it? It's about taking your ego out of the food. It's not, you know, it's not ego cooking.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I've got chefs in a restaurant that I can either sit them in the back kitchen, give them little water baths and, you know, scientific equipment and let them time to get these little perfect little bits of meat, or I can light a big fire in the middle of the room and throw them in the deep end and just get them to chuck bits of meat about and cut up whole animals. One would give you more precise, you know, I don't think more delicious, but, you know, more Michelin worthy food. And the other one is more fun to work with, and I think that comes out in the food. You know, it's not always perfect. Nothing's always perfect.
Is that how you sold it to investors? Because I'm interested in the people that backed you guys and gave you the money to build these beautiful restaurants with these great fire pits in the middle and people having a good time, but with input, like, no two meals ordered the same, look the same. It's about good food. How did you sell it to
investors? I mean, they didn't get it at first. They now love it, obviously. Yeah. But I think initially they came in and they're like, I don't get this. Yeah. It's like, and then we started doing, you know, 600-800 people a day. And they're like, oh, I get it now. So, well, we have
but it,
to.
But it was a gamble for them, was it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'd opened four successful restaurants in the trot that had made money. So I guess I had track record in that, and there was enough around me to attract attention, media attention. And my idea was good, you know, I mean, it's something nobody was doing before, and they looked at the monetary side of the whole animal thing is quite interesting, because obviously we buy meat a lot cheaper than other places, and meat prices are high at the moment. So I think it's the only way, almost the only way you can go. And the theatre aspect, they got it, you know. You sat there, I mean, you go to a guy and you say, well, let's build a restaurant in the middle of the Soho with a 6-metre fire pit in the middle of the room, loads of tequila and mezcal and barbecue food. It's like, yeah, that'll work.
Yeah, take the kids.
Yeah, fine. Yeah, when are you open? Yeah.
If you're having the time of your life on this podcast, why don't you tell us about it by leaving us a review? We'd love to hear from you. That leads me a little bit back onto the vegan stuff, because so the story goes roughly that you were somehow, for some reason, targeted by some really extreme vegans, not all vegans by any means, a really extreme little group that sent you vile abuse the whole time. And what was really, really impressive about that thing before they literally drove you off Facebook was you spent about 6 months genuinely trying to engage them and talk to them and explain to them and talk about some of the way you source meats and how much you care. And also even about, you know, I'm not all about meat. I think we should eat less meat and treat it as a premium. Yeah. Like, you tried. You worked really hard.
Extremists are extremists. You know, you talk about extremists in any walk of life. You know, you're never going to convince them around. Any sort of extremism tend to be a bit shit, you know. There's no extremist behaviour that's good
that
or positive.
That should be a T-shirt, shouldn't it? Extremism, you know, just a bit
but
shit.
I think when talking to these people, it wasn't these people I was trying to convince. I was more trying to convince the people around these people.
Right.
So, you know, the people that look to these people, you know,
there was a bit of purpose behind you trying
to
lose
I mean, I think I believe in the vegan cause. I think it's, you know, I get what they're saying. I don't think they fully understand the nature of farming in this country. They don't, you know, everything. I've watched Cowspiracy. They're always like, oh, have you seen Cowspiracy? I was like, yeah, I've seen it. You know, it's about America. It's not about the UK. You know, this is about a production line that you're demonising, which you're quite right to demonise, and I'm against it too, which doesn't happen in this country or in most of Europe. You know, so I don't understand why you keep on coming up with these numbers. Oh, you know, it's the end of the world and all the money. You know, these are little cows that I'm using that are on a grazing field that is purely naturally irrigated. You know, it's water that's coming down. There's no extra water used up. Nobody's starving from water because this cow is eating it. It's natural land that's getting fertilized by the cow. If you take these cows off this land, A, you don't have fertilizer, and B, you wouldn't be able to plant anything on it because it has the wrong irrigation profile. And C, these farmers, they herd these cattle, not for profit. They're not trying to make big bucks for these things. It tends to be for the fertilizer and the fact that, you know, they have this spare bit of land that's what they're doing with it. You know, it's not...
Look, I said I was impressed with you for engaging with them. I think you're going down a road you'll never come back out alive if you... I believe you, but when you say, look, I believe in the vegan cause, it's like they're never going to take that from
you. No, they're not. I don't expect them to. I mean, the difference of opinion is I'm probably closer to their level of thinking than most people.
Yeah. So moving away from vegans...
please.
Vegans
and Gordon Ramsay.
I feel like the one thing I'd never have guessed is how comfortable you are with what I call fame. And one of my colleagues said to me, do you think Neil... Is that a fair question? Because do you think Neil feels he's famous? I don't know. I don't know if he feels famous, but he's in the public eye and people know who he is. And I get a lot of people... I mean, I literally ride off the back of our friendship by telling people, quite brutally. But you deal with fame in quite a comfortable way, it seems. In fact, you don't hold back when it's time to take to Twitter and voice your opinion on stuff outside of food. You're not holding back, and yet you're in the public eye. Is there any conflict in you at all?
My PR, there's quite a lot of conflict with my PR.
And how does your PR feel? I mean, you get a shitload of great PR.
Yeah, I know, but it does. And I guess they I mean, I'm just being honest, you know, and I've always done that. And I guess I think that's why more people follow me, and that's why people come to me, because there's that sense of that, you know.
It's really you.
I'm not bullshitting. I'm never racist. I'm never sexist. I'm never, you know, anti things, you know, that I shouldn't be. I'm not an IST person, really, you know. But I'm
outspoken. But the fame side, is it comfortable for you? I mean, I know.
I don't really
like
see
get,
it as that, you know. I mean, I don't. I'm not the level of fame that it's.
But it's uncomfortable. So you get to travel a lot. And
I'm at the perfect level, as in I get respect from my peers, which is exactly what I want.
Yeah.
But I don't, you know, I don't get weird people coming up to me in the street. I mean, a friend of mine.
What? Never.
No. I mean, some of my friends, like guys like Professor Green and people like that. I mean, we're in a restaurant and people just come up and, you know, harass him. And I wouldn't want that. That would be uncontrollable.
I love Tom Kerridge and Club Boss, you know. I don't want them in my kitchen. That's why would I want them in my kitchen? They're better than me.
You were always up for being quite honest and just helping people out. I remember the very, very first time we met. Neil and I grew up at university in an era, believe it or not, where email was a brand new thing. And Salford University actually had an email room. In halls where there were 7 computers that you used to queue for hours to go and sit at one for 20 minutes and write an email. It was very exciting.
And I didn't really get it.
Neil and I were part of the same group in the early days of halls. He was somebody I hadn't really spoken to yet, but I could see was seemed like quite a strong, silent type, but with a bit of presence, and I was quite impressed. The first time we actually spoke, Neil and I were sat together in the email room. And Neil's first time in the email room, he sent an email to everybody on the university faculty whose surnames began with A, and he wrote the following email: "Do you know that all of your names begin with A? You're welcome. Love, Neil." To which he got an email back saying, "You are now banned from email for the rest of your university career." So while I was high-tech emailing the shit out of people, Neil had to walk around campus talking to people.
Letters.
And, you know, meeting. Yeah. Very funny. It was just that was when I first became right. This guy could be my pal.
I didn't really get the computer at all.
No,
I didn't understand how far it would go out to people. I think it went to about 1 million people.
It went to like 20,000 people in students and staff that these days began with. They were all as unfortunate as one another to get your email. But
yeah, I mean, it was helpful, I think.
Yeah. Tell me this: you and I are both from outside of London, but you've made your name and hopefully your fortune here. Are you a Londoner?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm indeed. I consider myself a Londoner.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I still look back to Edinburgh as being, you know, where I grew up. But I don't feel at home. I feel very home here. I love the multiculturalism. I think that's what comes out of my food. You know, if you look at what we're doing in the restaurant, a lot of people are like, well, why are you, you know, why would you make a weird Japanese curry thing? Why would you do this? That's, you know, that? And I believe that's what London's given me. It's given me that
opportunity.
An opportunity to see many different cultures and stuff that I didn't really grow up with. I think that's what lacking in Edinburgh. I love Edinburgh for Edinburgh, and I love it. It's a beautiful, beautiful city. And it's getting much better now, but it's multicultural. It isn't, you know.
Last time we spoke, you said you don't often get back there. And the only thing that jarred with me is that your family's still there. Your mum, your brother, your stepdad.
Yeah, I mean, but my brother comes down and my mum comes down. I was there the other week. Yeah. I did a talk at my old school.
Oh, really? How did that
go? Yeah, it's good. It was like
at Watson's?
No, Merkston. The place I went after that.
Oh, expelled from Watson's?
No, I didn't get expelled from Watson's. I got moved to the boarding school.
Yeah, it's a different word for it.
It was like, I had to tell them that as well. They were like, so why did you come here? I was like, because it was a punishment.
I got moved,
It was a punishment. It's like, if you do badly at school, you'll get sent to Merkston.
You went to talk to the current students?
Yeah, it's like a healthy eating week. So
did it go well?
Yeah, and then taught some kids how to cook and things. It was good.
What a really nice thing to do.
It was really nice.
The new restaurant, you're building an empire, Covent Garden, and
yes.
The pizza this time. Tell me about
pizza.
That.
Well, I like pizza.
Is that it?
Do you like pizza?
I love it.
Exactly.
You know I do.
So why wouldn't I do a pizza restaurant? That's my level of thinking. It's like, you know, they're like, why are you doing a pizza restaurant? It's like, do you like pizza? Yes. Well, why wouldn't I?
What's the Monster Munch thing, though? You love Monster Munch. Like, what's
that's
the Monster
on one thing. No, I tell you
tell
what
me
it
what
is.
It's on.
I'll tell you what it is. It's on a crab taco, and it's just a crumb. So what we do is we take the pork skin. We cook pork skin until it's, you know, sort of like chicharroni. It's really crunchy. And we season it, so we sort of blitz up the Monster Munch because it's that pickled onion. I couldn't duplicate it in any other way, and there's a little bit of that goes through it. But it's delicious. And it was only a mistake because we were tasting... I was doing everything in my flat, so I had like a week before we opened Temple One. And we were doing photographs of everything and doing all the, you know... all the media stuff and testing all the recipes, and we couldn't get any pork skin. So I said to the guy, I was like, and I've got a little shop in my flats, and I was like, just go down and see if they've got any puffed pork skin. I said, if not, get some Monster Munch because it looks the same, you know. So we chopped that up into little bits and stuck it on just for the photograph. And I went, oh, I'm going to try it. And I was like, you know what? This works.
It works.
It's kind of weird. We've moved to Space Raiders now, though, which I'm a little bit dubious about.
Cheaper or...?
Yeah, I mean, no, it's just availability more than that. It's quite hard to get Monster Munch.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think I'm feeling a little bit like I've sold out, you know. I'm not. I was a defender of Monster Munch. Yeah. And I don't. But other people, I don't know. Are you a Space Raiders guy or a Monster Munch?
I was both. We went swimming on a Monday and you could get both in the vending machine, both 10p.
Yeah.
Are you mellow? Because it feels like, as we've grown up together, you've been a really steady guy, great to know, but you've always... You've not loved an argument, but you never back down from one and you always stand your ground. Are you mellowing out? Are you happy now? I think, two restaurants, one on the way.
I mean, I have work worries and stress and things like that, but I'm probably in the happiest place I've been ever. I was thinking about this morning, actually. I was thinking, you know, I woke up with a shocking hangover and a dubious text message I sent last night to Sarah. I was like, oh, shit, shouldn't have done that. And then I was like, actually, you know, it's fun.
Here's an annoying thing. Why haven't you aged?
I think because I'd never been in the sun.
Is that right? Is that
the secret? I think that's the kind of thing. I never shave, wet shave, and I never go in the sun.
You literally look the same as you did.
I think that's the only thing, because I'm just basically blue. So there's no, I don't think you could age. It's like most people are a little bit like sun-dried tomatoes, aren't they? They just get that sort of wrinkly after a while. Whereas I think I've just never been in the sun.
Oh, well, I've got the same face I'll have till I'm 60.
I don't really tan, though, when I go on holiday.
Don't you?
Yeah, I just suddenly burn, and then it just peels off, and that's it.
Well, you look great.
I reflect heat. Hot friend, I
love you so. 60 Second Rebellion with Neil Rankin, Rebel Chef. Quickly, advice to your 16-year-old self.
Don't worry about exams, just educate yourself. Learn a language.
Your 16-year-old self's advice to the grown-up you.
Fuck off.
Nice. I mean, I remember that you. I fell in love with that you.
See, I could give as much advice to my 16-year-old self, he'd tell me to fuck off. Yeah.
The most important single character trait for any founder, entrepreneur or leader?
Not fearing failure.
Really? Have you failed?
Yeah, loads. Lost my entire business.
You did lose
your
business.
Fucked up three careers.
Marriage. I'm just piling on the pain here.
So you look back at it, it's mostly a series of fuck-ups.
Yeah. Question 4. You're given the power and money to solve one big global problem and one tiny, annoying, day-to-day, small first-world problem.
Big problem, plastic in the ocean. I think that's going to fuck us.
First-world small problem that you'd solve. What annoys you every day?
It's traffic here.
Traffic, yeah. What are you most excited about?
The new restaurant opening.
When's it opening?
May.
Rebel Chef Neil Rankin, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you for having me.
Post-match analysis. Post-match analysis with the Rebel Tech founders, Nicole Lyons and Mark Schwakey.
Hello.
Hi. So, Neil Rankin.
So I love when you get Neil in a room, especially you two together. You've got great banter. It did leave me wanting more. I've got to be honest. Like he got to the end where he mentioned his fuck ups in personal and professional life, which was the stuff that everyone wants to hear about. So it was great, but it really did make me go, okay, where's part two?
Yeah, I think we're going to do another one with Neil. There's so much to cover with that guy. He's got stories about coming out of where he was at university. He's got stories about being literally on life's floor after having had some pretty bad stuff happen to him and deciding on a new career and following it with vigor. He's had some serious fuck-ups, and I don't think he'd be, knowing Neil wouldn't be against coming back and doing some more. So yeah, I think there's room for another go at that.
Agreed.
Yeah. That's it for today's episode of Rebel Talk. I've been your host, Mark Schwakey. Thank you so much for listening. My thanks go to our brilliant production team at Hard Six Audio, to Spirit Land in King's Cross for the beautiful studio, to my Rebel Tech colleagues and producers, Nicole Lyons and Meg Wright. Until next time, up the Rebels. Rebels, Rebel, you tore your dress. Rebels, Rebel, your face is a mess. Rebels, Rebel, how could they know? Hot track, I love you. So I'm here with Neil Rankin. Hello, Neil.
Hello, Mark.
That was sexy.